Radio Influence, podcasting redefined.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tennis with an Accent. This is Saqib, and today I'm joined by ATP live feed commentator and a very known name in tennis, Nick Lester, coming here for the third time. Nick, thanks for doing this.
Pleasure, Saqib. Pleasure.
And again, big thanks before we start the show, our partners, RadioInfluence.com, who have been partnering us on this podcast and have helped us reach a wider global audience. So I'm sure they'll really like, the audience would like to hear from Nick. So Nick, you just recently covered Shanghai. So my question is for the remainder of the season. I want to start with the fall season. Growing up, when I was following tennis in the Becker Sampras era, or even before that, was very exciting. Right now, with the top quality of Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, even Murray, these guys get confirmations as early as July, and a lot of times casual tennis fans don't see the reason for the season to extend. But I still find it very engaging because there are a lot of stories within the stories. And tennis is just beyond, a little beyond the big guys. Of course, big guys bring in the seat, people in the seats and the coverage and everything. So how do you look at the remaining of the season and how important this swing of the season is for you?
I think from I'll speak from a player's point of view. Clearly, there are a fair few tired bodies at this time of year. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, tennis is an exceptional long season, as we all know. So I think this time of year is often a challenging one for a lot of players. But there's a number of goals. Obviously, there's a certain Serbian who looks to be about as engaged maybe as if we've ever seen him. Certainly, watching him this week was quite frightening at times, to be honest, for the rest of the field. Going into the rest of the season, he's clearly got his eyes on returning to the number one spot again. His hunger is right back where it needs to be. And, it's big picture wise. Obviously, we go into 3 weeks in Europe now, which is key for London, primarily for the guys. And also, let's be honest about it. Let's look at the ATP World Tour as a whole. It's also key for a lot of guys to try and get into the Australian Open directly, because we may not see guys ranked 100 or 110 too often, but that's where these next couple of months are obviously very key for those guys as well, because they want to be getting directly into the Australian Open. So points and prize money, and with the challenge, with the changes as well to the transition tour, if we're looking big picture, the next couple of months is, or the next 6 weeks or 5 weeks is, there's a lot of there's a lot on the line.
I think very well said. That's the point, because there are always stories within the stories. Of course, every game is, led by the stars, and stars bring in the business, like I said. But like you said, there are a lot of players who are trying to be seeded. There are a lot of players who are trying to make the main draw. And because Australia is quite a trip, and I'm sure a lot of players financially also debate if they go all the way, they only enter the Auckland qualifying or Australian Open qualifying. I'm sure those are conversations they have with their team, because not everyone, has the same financial backing like some of the top stars.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Everyone's focusing on London, understandably so, and who's going to make it and who's not going to make it, and what Novak's obviously doing at the moment, which is looking very ominous for everyone else at this stage of the season. But, there's a lot to play for. There's a lot of jockeying to be done. You do get a lot of players, obviously, who have had time away, who have been injured, who can sometimes benefit from this stage of the year because they're a bit fresher. They're coming in a bit fresher. Conditions indoors in Europe are pretty quick. Being obviously indoors makes things a little bit quicker in the first place. So there's that to consider. I personally, obviously Asia is still relatively new to the calendar in terms of this sort of 3 week swing. This Asian swing's all, relatively new. They're trying to, the ATP tour are trying to make it happen over here. My memories of Paris-Bercy, for example, are fantastic when I was growing up. And Paris-Bercy is still one of the best, if not the best atmosphere at a Masters 1000. So, there might be a few tired bodies and everything else, but in terms of an atmosphere, if we're looking at a Masters, the last one is arguably one of the very best.
So let me go back, a few years ago, Nick, since we are the same generation. So why do you think Sampras and Becker came so charged in this part of the season Federer and Djokovic haven't shied away either. But overall, I thought there was a lot of life left in this part of the season when players like even Jakub Alesek and, you know, Thomas Muster and Marcelo Rios, it used to be a different feeling. Right now, like you rightfully said, this year is better than last year because at this point last year, a lot of top men called it a season and the field wasn't your usual field in London. So why do you think, is it just the physical grind of the game, points are longer? What has changed this, that this season, this part of the season usually gets affected?
Well, I think to answer your first question about Sampras and Becker, I mean, there's no doubt that obviously in the 90s, the court surfaces indoors were quick. You know, this is not what the guys are going to experience in the next 3 weeks is not what the guys were facing in the 90s when they were playing on, you know, not supreme courts as we would know it, but, you know, relatively quick, low bouncing courts. So it was a different, conditions were very different, weren't they, in the 90s across the tour. I think in terms of, you know, to answer your question with regards to players these days in terms of staying on the tour and being able to stay healthy, you know, I guess for the big guys, you know, the top four or five, they're obviously targeting the Masters. They're so big. I mean, let's be honest about it. If you look at Rafa's record in the autumn in the last handful of seasons, it's very poor, isn't it? Either he's not been around particularly or he's not performed that well. So we know he's never won Paris. We know he's never won London. So I think from Nadal's perspective, you can look at it and say, well, actually, certainly in recent times, he's not really performed after the US Open, you know, be it injury or whatever it might be. He's not been able to produce his best tennis. I know he made the final in Shanghai last year, but he's one of those guys who hasn't really, you know, he has kind of fallen away a little bit. Federer, you know, on the other hand, has been able to pace himself so well because of not the lack of tournaments, but obviously he misses the clay court season now. So he's a guy who's been able to tailor his season. Basel is always going to be, you know, for what's left, the last couple of years of his career, going to be a big one. And yeah, you know, these other guys in the mix. You know, I think the one thing I would say, Zakib, is if you look at Paris, I think in the last decade, as a Masters 1000, it has had the most upsets and the most amount of surprises in terms of seeds being beaten there early of any Masters 1000 across the year. I read some good data recently by Jeff Sackman, who I'm sure you follow on Tennis Abstract, who wrote an excellent piece about that. And he effectively was saying that Paris, as a Masters 1000, has the largest amount of upsets. And obviously the reason for that generally is because there are a certain amount of players who do come in holiday mode somewhat. They are ready to go away and have a break, and that's why you get the odd upset there.
Yeah, I think that I see the correlation, and that does make sense because they're like fatigued bodies and, you know, there's mental fatigue, the travel fatigue, and, you know, the way the tour is. But I still enjoy, you know, the other stories. And before we talk about the top men, because last time you came on the podcast a year and a half ago, you talked about Paolo Lorenzi. Is there any other player that excites you who's not, you know, a household name or who's just, you know, grinding it out and making his name in the lower echelon of the rankings?
As things stand, yeah, I mean, there's plenty. I mean, I really have enjoyed John Millman's rise this year. I know John's obviously propelled himself to a top 40 player, but I have so much respect for John as a person and as a professional. Got to spend quite a bit of time with him this week, actually, in Shanghai, and a real class act. Really happy for him. In terms of sort of guys in their 30s that have played well, you know, I take just looking down the rankings, one name who I see has been playing a lot of challenges this week. Marcel Grenoyers is a guy who is now 32 years of age. We talk about that Australian Open direct entrance. I notice he's been playing a lot of challenges in the last few weeks. I watched him play a couple of challenges in the States. There's a guy who, you know, trying to get back to his best. Tommy Robredo's story this year at the US Open was incredible, and I loved his interview afterwards, and he talked about the passion he has for the game, and he was effectively saying, for me, it doesn't matter what I've achieved in the past. It's I'm here because I want to play and I want to compete, and my body still says yes. So, yeah, you know, there's if you look, you could take the top 100, you could certainly dig deep in each one and find everyone has a different route and a different tale to tell as to how they got there.
Absolutely. And Nick, let me just put you on the spot here, because there's a term that's been used in tennis for quite some time, journeyman. And you've been a player yourself, and you cover the tour you know, with the best seat in the house, you talk to the players. First of all, is the term offensive? And secondly, when you describe a player, I'm sure players don't care, but if we are insulting someone. Or secondly, what is your definition of a journeyman?
Yeah, not a fan of that phrase, really, particularly. I don't see how that really correlates for a player on the ATP World Tour. You might get some journeymen on the Futures Tour, guys who enjoy being on the Futures Tour, have got a bit of money. I recently actually read a book about the Futures Tour, a very good book, and there was a couple of good stories in there. And one person called the Futures Tour the Millionaire's Playground, because you do get a lot of players on the Futures Tour who have got a lot of money because they're not making any, and they're quite happy to play and enjoy themselves. So there might be a few journeymen on the Futures Tour, but I don't think there are too many journeymen anywhere else, certainly not in the top 100, not 150. No, I'm not really buying into that personally.
Okay, well said. All right, so let's move our focus back to, you know, what's lying ahead. Is there anyone you think who can crash the party? Because right now the top eight or top nine look like, eight of those nine will make it to London. Is there anyone who can just sneak in there with like a few good weeks, say in, you know, maybe Stockholm and then Basel and Bercy, for example?
You know what? I'm struggling to see it. I mean, I'm struggling to see a guy making a big run. I know Jack Sock did it last year, but I think we have to consider that this year the bar is higher. You know, the eighth ranked player coming into this week, I think, was Kevin Anderson, I want to say, or maybe he was the seventh ranked player. I need to check, actually. In fact, sorry, the eighth ranked player was Dominic Thiem coming into this week, who had 3,500 points. Now, last year after Paris, the eighth ranked player had 3,000 points. So you're getting a feel that already the eighth ranked player now has a lot more points on the board. So the bar has been raised this year. You know, the prizes have not been shared around quite as readily. They've been kept by a few more guys. So, John, I know John Isner's playing all 3 weeks, isn't he? He's playing Stockholm this week, so he's going to make a go of it. I guess Kei Nishikori could be someone who might well put a bit of pressure on Dominic Thiem in that eighth position, but can't really see it. I know Milos Raonic has made the final in Paris as well, so you can make a case. But it's gonna take one of those guys to win Paris. I think it's fair to say these guys are 1,000 points behind, so it's gonna need probably Thiem to lose first round of Austria and probably first round of Paris, and then it's gonna need Raonic to come in and Nishikori probably to come in and make a final or a semi final somewhere. So I think probably those guys are set. John Isner. The only thing I would say about John is he is fresh. You know, he hasn't played since Laver Cup, so he's had 3 weeks rest. He didn't play at all in Asia, just become a dad, so he's probably feeling pretty good about life. So I would suggest John, you know, John has the capabilities and has played well in Paris, maybe to put some points on the board, but I think it's going to be tough to knock those top eight out now.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a tough act. I 100% agree with you there. Even though Borna Coric had a great week in China, he has to be fatigued, and the transition usually from Asia to Europe sometimes cannot be smooth. So what did you learn of his tennis? I know he's shown steady progress since he hired Ricardo Piatti and team, and I even briefly spoke with him in Miami. His serve's been spot on, and we had a glimpse of it against Federer when Federer just won, I think, 9 points in the match. And Federer, you know, could have played better, but I think a lot had to do with Coric. So what's your take on, you know, his growth and steady progress this year?
I've been very impressed with Coric, personally as well. Again, we're lucky this week in Shanghai. We get player lounge access, so we get to see and talk to a lot of players. Been very impressed with the way Coric held himself, actually. I've spoken to him a fair bit. I think he's grown up a lot. Very mature young man, very personable. I think we always knew when we saw him as a 17-year-old how much of an unbelievable competitor he was. I was lucky enough to be in Basel in the front row, actually, when he beat Nadal at age 17. This guy was getting the fist pumps out every single point. You know, he loved the competition. And now I think he's become a more refined competitor, I guess might be one way of describing it. You know, his emotions are a little more under control, I think it's fair to say. Game-wise, he's got bigger. He is fantastic physically. This guy can run all day. Very impressive athlete. Always was. You know, always was as a big build. Serves got bigger. I think, you know, even though we were talking to Hawkeye this week, numbers-wise, they're not up a whole lot in terms of speed, first serve, but they are up a little bit. But I think accuracy-wise, the forehand has developed as well. But I think he's grown up a lot. I think he's not, you know, he's got a good setup now with Riccardo Piatti. I think you don't see his dad travel quite as much. Again, I'm not casting any stereotypes about that, but I think that's probably helped him, you know, just to be on his own a little bit more, make some decisions for himself as well. Yeah, and a very personable guy, you know, very personable guy, and I'm pleased for him because I do like the way he competes. You know, he's fun to watch, and you know, he's now very close to a place in the world's top 10. And you look at some of the ranking drops that are going to happen with Goffin in there as well. He could well be very close to being a top 10 player come the end of the year.
No, I think I fully see, you know, your point, and Joris definitely has shown, you know, very steady growth, and again, you know, got the better of Federer 2 out of 3 matches this year. So let's talk about the man who he beat in the semis, Roger Federer. And you also posted something on Twitter showing the court index speed, and Shanghai is clearly, I think, the quickest of the surfaces in terms of the Masters 1000 and majors. So when Federer loses, of course, there's a reaction from fans, and, you know, fans are entitled because, you know, we know he's extended his twilight brilliantly. But at the same time, some of the, you know, media personnel are insinuating or maybe introducing a retirement talk, and I think that does take away from Joric's win, and Federer still, I think, is going to be number 3 tomorrow. So what's your take on this kind of adverse reaction? I know that's not your style. You never bring this kind of talk in Twitter or in your matches, but you think we need to react this adversely just because Federer lost the semifinals in the Masters 1000?
No, not particularly. I think we have to take into consideration the big picture. Federer's had a lot on over the last 6 to 8 weeks. I'm not making excuses for him, but from what I understand, he hasn't been at home at all. He's been away a lot, you know, from pretty much Cincinnati. I think he hasn't been home since Cincinnati because they stayed. I think Team Federer stayed in up in the States after the U.S. Open, so they stayed for Labor Cup. You know, one thing you've got to remember about Federer is, and one thing I have learned a lot in this year, is how many commitments Roger has away from tennis. You know, last week he was in Japan giving a lot to Uniqlo and all the sponsors he has over there. He comes to Shanghai. We underestimate, I think, what he has to do off court and how he balances his life as one of the most well-known, respected, renowned people, let alone athletes, people in the world. And how he manages it on court. And he does a remarkable job, and I don't think he gets enough credit for that. You know, this week, did he look a little bit tired? Maybe. You know, conditions were quick. The one thing I would say, the one caveat I would add, is that at night the balls do slow down a bit, and the balls they were using this week were quite heavy, and I think that helped Joric yesterday. And, you know, you look at the matchup with Joric yesterday. We so often talk about Federer returning well and neutralizing the big serves. He couldn't do that yesterday for whatever reason. You know, Joric played lights out. You know, we were just talking about some of the numbers that he posted. Joric put a lot of pressure on me. He couldn't break Joric down yesterday. He couldn't find a way through Joric. You know, whether he drew him in short, whether he was able to use a bit of slice to come forward, it didn't happen for him. And, you know, he didn't get that many free points off his serve, which we're used to seeing. Joric defended beautifully, and it was a little bit like, if I may suggest this, it was a little bit like watching Novak play Roger when he was beating him, because Federer couldn't find a way through, and that's full credit to Joric. You know, as you say, people will always look for Roger's any kind of sign that Roger might just be on the wane. Listen, if he's lost...
Yeah, I think that's it. It's a good story. You're right. Anytime, you know, because it draws engagement and angry fans or fans, you know, rational fans, everybody reacts to it. But it's just, I think, it's a little too soon when the guy is playing, you know, decent tennis, NC final and semifinals here and, you know, US Open fourth round. So, and let's talk.
It's all relative.
Yeah. And the balls are heavy. You know, a lot of time we do get caught up in the surfaces. Rafa Nadal and a lot of top players have said in the past it's a different ball they use pretty much on a weekly basis, not necessarily, you know, the different ball every week, but it's, you know, ball doesn't get repeated, and that does add to adjustments and, you know, maybe injuries. I don't know. I'm not that qualified, but I'm sure there's a connect somewhere. So when you draw the charts and
I think it's a little tougher on the body.
Yeah, and on Twitter about the court index. So you think the sport is in a healthy position with the different court speeds, or are you in for little more speeding up for different surfaces, or the way it stands is there's nothing broken?
No, I'd definitely be in for more speeding up of surfaces without a shadow of a doubt. I think especially the next 3 weeks. I mean, the only issue you slightly have is that obviously Paris and London try to mirror each other, because even though those court place indexes were a little different for Paris and London, Paris and London do try to, understandably so, beat to the same drum in terms of their court speed. So they want to have something that, you know, guys are going to get some preparation time on. You know, I think as well, Shakib, you have to look down at the lower levels a little bit as well and say, well, you know, are we going to speed the courts up at challenger level? Because it's the challenge. It's the guys that are winning at challenges are the ones that are going to come through to be good and to join the ATP World Tour. So do we need to also speed it up at challenger level? And then the guys that are winning at that level, who can play a more aggressive brand of tennis or all-round brand of tennis, can then come and do their thing on the ATP World Tour. So I wouldn't just be only concerned about speeding it up at the highest level, but I'd also be concerned about speeding it up down the levels as well. So that's a big ask. Tournament directors over the last 10 years have clearly been quite afraid of making it a serve bot, if you like, that's the right word, fest, and they've slowed things down. But you know, we have seen signs. Australia obviously was a bit quicker. US Open this year was slower. Definitely, the balls were definitely chewing up at the US Open. So you know, I think we've got to have a time of year. For me, it would be really nice if we had the next 3 or 4 weeks as some nice quick conditions. But we'll see.
Let me ask you a typical fan question, because that's what I am. Australian Open has been playing pretty quick since, I believe, 2014. And when they get the roof on, I know with the roof, the elements are out. You know, there's no wind, especially, and if it's during day, there is no sun. But does that affect the speed of the court? Or in fact, with the humidity and the conditions in the stadium, the balls get heavier, and does it slow the conditions?
Well, listen, obviously, I've never played at that level. So for me, I'm not necessarily qualified, but I can tell you what I know in terms of speaking to players and speaking to, following the game as I have done for the past 15 years on tour. I think there's a number of factors that play into that. I also think, Shakib, the size of the court is often not talked about enough. You know, here in Shanghai, very big court. I'm talking about the surroundings. That clearly helps defenders who have got more time and more space. So, yes, it might be a quick court in terms of the actual surface, but it's the space around the court. Rome is always for me, obviously it's a clay court, so it's a different dynamic, but Rome has very little movement around the back of the court. So you can't stand quite so deep. You can't defend quite as wide. Madrid, on the other hand, is the opposite. So I think that has to be in the conversation a little bit too. To answer your question directly about specific, you know, courts within majors, I often have conversations with players and they will tell me, grandstand is slow, but you know what? Court six is really quick. So there are a lot of variables and it does change a lot within a certain tournament, I think. Why is that the case? I'm not 100% sure. I'm guessing, you know, a lot of it's to do maybe with climatic conditions. As you say, if you've got a full house, US Open, for example, this year, the humidity was so high in the Arthur Ashe Stadium. It was remarkable. I remember actually being inside the Arthur Ashe Stadium and stepping out, and I couldn't believe how much air there was outside the stadium. So, you know, that gives you an idea of the differences, you know, that you can get climatically. So there's a lot of little bits and things. The one thing I will say is, as well, you might speak to one player and they'll tell you one thing, and you might speak to another and they'll tell you something else. So it is quite personal.
Okay. A couple more and before we let you go. So Novak Djokovic, again, you know, we can't say enough how, you know, he was left for the dead by many people in March. I had my doubts, but I didn't think, you know, he's done. But what he's done is remarkable. Now it looks like the man cannot lose a set or a match. So what do you see for the remainder of the season? Of course, his focus is back. He's with the striking distance to become number one, like you already said. Is there anyone who can stand in his way between now and World Tour Finals? Can we expect some challenge?
I mean, I really hope Juan Martín Del Potro is fit. The knee knock that he got this week was a rather innocuous looking one, but I saw him hobbling the next morning out of the hotel. I hope he's okay. Again, I don't have really an inside line on it, but I hope he's okay, because I think he has a game, he has a weapon that can really hurt Djokovic. However, in saying that, having seen Novak play up close and personal every match this week, He is making guys come out of their comfort zone pretty early in matches as well. I mean, you look at Zverev yesterday, you look at Čorić today, both guys playing a very good sort of two or three games initially, four games living with him. They get broken and then they're down a break. They're down 4-2. And the same thing happened with both guys. They are forced to play at a level at which they are not comfortable at. They're suddenly trying to hit winners from difficult parts of the court. They're not panicking, but there is an element of, how do I get through this guy? And then they're suddenly missing balls because they're playing above a level that they're comfortable at. And that is what Djokovic is doing to opponents right now. I think his serve, Novak's serve, I mean, we obviously know that the numbers are he didn't drop serve this week, but he was serving incredibly well this week. And I wonder whether that is a shot. We know he obviously had a lot of problems with that earlier in the season. It's a different serve now to what it was in Indian Wells and Miami. So that for me has improved a little bit. I think, you know, he's so tight with that. Once he gets the grip of a rally, he just completely his ability to control the middle of the court is extraordinary. And then he's so hard to outmaneuver. So honestly, I think he is looking so focused right now. And he looked so far ahead of everyone else this week that it's going to take a mighty task, I think, to stop him for the rest of the season.
Okay. All right. So let's conclude this conversation with Sasha Zverev. When you came on the podcast last year in April, you said something that I've used, and it really made sense to me. I've used in a lot of Zverev arguments and discussions that we are not going to judge him on a weekly basis. He's as talented as he is. He's still a work in progress. And every time he loses, all hell breaks loose. So are you still sticking to your mantra? Are you still giving him time? Lendl's on board. What's the report card for Zverev looking from the Leicester point of view?
I mean, I thought he played well this week. I thought he served well this week. I thought he looked to be taking the ball on a little bit more. I mean, you heard the conversation Federer had with him at the Laver Cup, I'm sure, about trying to step in a little bit more, trying to take the ball earlier, take time away from opponents, if he can do that a bit better. You know, a couple of matches I did, his at the US Open, were a little worrying. The defeat to Philipp Kohlschreiber, he was out-thought that day. You know, Kohlschreiber used the slice backhand so well to draw Zverev off the baseline, and Zverev was completely discombobulated, if I can use that word. He just looked as though he didn't know what to do. So tactically, I think from that regard, he's obviously got a bit more astute. Does he volley well at the moment? Questionable. I still think that's an area of his game that, you know, when he's transitioning forwards, is he comfortable enough? You know, I think those are areas he can improve. I think mentally, you know, he's got a lot better than he was last year. You know, he's managing his frustrations. You know, he looked pretty relaxed yesterday. Again, I know he was beaten pretty badly and probably came off court thinking there's not a lot I could do there, which is probably the best way to deal with it. But yeah, I mean, his forehand is, again, if he can start to take that shot on and get the confidence in it, and Lendl can maybe help him with regards to that side of things, then I'm not too concerned about where he's at. I mean, you know, for a guy to back up what he did last year, let's not forget he's 21 years of age still. He's still in the next gen race. You know, he's still in the race for Milan. So I know he's not going to play there, but that's as far as his age is concerned. Yeah, for me, I think he's firmly on track. He'll be a major winner in my eyes.
Okay. All right, Nick, I think we got what we wanted from you as usual. I'm sure the audiences would really be thrilled to hear this discussion. Actually, your analysis. I was just asking questions. Again, thanks for doing this and look forward to having you soon when the next season rolls around.
Pleasure, Saqib.
Hey, this is Bobby Sue Doyle-Hazard, host of Leveling the Playing Field, a podcast truly focused on women in the sports world. I'm so excited to bring this to you. It is for young women who are looking to get into the sports industry and women who are already in their careers, also looking to make a change. I want to put a spotlight on the amazing women that we have in sports now, and hopefully we can all learn a little something. Please make sure to subscribe to my podcast, Leveling the Playing Field, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and with my guys at RadioInfluence.com.